Well, hello everybody. Thank you for sticking around till the end of the day. I really appreciate that. Just a little light, simple, easy stuff to do at 5 o'clock and day three of tech ed. Hopefully we're all fully alert and ready to go and as caffeinated as you need to be. My name is Kate Gregory. If you haven't met me before, I've been using C++, I like to say, since before Microsoft had a C++ compiler. And in February of this year, they celebrated the 20th anniversary of having a C++ compiler, so I guess I've been doing it for more than 20 years. And pretty much exactly a year ago, at a different conference, the C++ team showed for the first time what C++ AMP, Accelerated Massive Parallelism, could do. And I was immediately hooked and have spent the last year really immersed in this technology. I'm writing a book on this. It is super cool. I'm not going to guarantee that the apps you're writing are good fits for AMP. Part of what we're going to talk about today is what kind of app is a good fit for AMP. But if you have an application that is data parallel and that could take advantage of not just 4 or 8 or 64 threads, but thousands or millions of threads doing your calculations, then you're going to be really excited about it as well. So let's start by kind of level set. First of all, how many of you, and I don't mean exclusively and I don't mean primarily, but how many of you think of yourself as C++ developers? That's pretty much the whole room, but not the entire room, which is kind of interesting. Those of you who don't think of yourself as C++ developers, perhaps the inspiration of what you can do with C++ AMP will change your minds. I think that one of the reasons we choose C++ when we're deciding, because I know a lot of languages and I choose the right language for the project, but speed at runtime and control over performance at runtime is a huge decision factor for why you would go with native C++ rather than some of the other languages that you know. And there are libraries out there to make your code even faster. Presumably, I've got good familiarity with PPL, the Parallel Patterns Library. Can I just have a quick show of hands if you know what it is? Wow, I would have expected more hands than that. That's like a third of the room. So the Parallel Patterns Library is a library, not a change to the C++ language, that lets you run your code across multiple CPU cores, which naturally, if it's the right kind of problem, will make it faster. If you are an experienced C++ developer, it's fair to say that you're productive in C++. There may be other languages in which you are also productive, but I'm willing to bet that C isn't one of them. Yes? So if you want to leverage the power of, say, the GPU, you may not want to do that in C or a C-like language. It may be very appealing to you to be able to do that in C++. And it may be very appealing to you to do that in Visual Studio. And that's a big part of the story of what C++ AMP is. Using the language you know, using the tool you know, getting this amazing performance, and being productive. Now, I have friends who have given up on C++ a decade ago and who giggle when I talk about being a productive developer in C++. But if you've stayed in C++ all this time, or if you're coming back to it now, you know that that can be very much a true statement. It's a language you know, it's a tool you know, and you can get a lot done very quickly in it. But as well, there's the matter of portability. How many of you target more than one operating system, like Windows and something else? See, that's a good third of the room. And that's important to us. And if you were going to write code that would use video cards to accelerate performance at runtime, how many of you wouldn't be able to guarantee the vendor of that video card? Again, again, a good quarter or so. So being portable has always been one of the hallmarks of C++. So one of the hallmarks of C++ AMP is that it's portable across different kinds of hardware, for example, different video card vendors. And that's really the story, that you have performance, productivity, and portability. Those three things add up to what C++ AMP is going to bring in terms of accelerating your code. I want to start by showing you what I mean when I talk about accelerating your code. I'm not going to show you this code to start with. It'll get its turn. Instead, I want to show you a sample which is from a book. I mentioned that I'm writing a C++ AMP book, and I'm writing it with Aide Miller, who has written a bunch of fantastic samples for use in the book, and this is one of them. And what this does is image manipulation. Now, there's some really important problems to be solved in image manipulation. I'm thinking about medical imaging and facial recognition for finding bad guys in airports and stuff. But the reason that you see it in demos is because it looks pretty compared to printing a number on the screen. So AMP is not a technology for exclusively image manipulation. It's just a demo that I choose because you can see what's going on. So what this does, and I'm going to get started because it takes 5 seconds. Oh, no, it doesn't when you're on C++ AMP. What this does is it goes through this picture and it makes it a little bit like a cartoon. It finds pixels that are next to each other with similar colors and it makes them the same color. And when it's done that a few times, it then goes through and draws black lines in between things that are different colors. So this, as you can imagine, is a massively parallel problem. When you're working on this section of white wall up here, it doesn't really matter whether you do that before or after you work on this little piece of gray step down here. So it's a problem that's just begging to be parallelized in various ways. So if I switch from CPU single core to CPU multi-core, this code uses the PPL to take advantage of the 4 cores that I have on this laptop, load up the raw image again, and cartoonize that. We go from 6.5 seconds to 2 seconds. And I've run this demo far more times than I wish to admit. And it's always on this machine about a third of the time. The one exception is if I record the demo with a video recording tool, so I've got something else chewing up some CPU time, then I can't get a 3x speed up. But that's about what I get the rest of the time. Okay, it's not bad. So we went from 6 seconds down to 2 seconds, but I can do better. So this is the AMP chosen in the dropdown. Same exact workload every time. You might have noticed that was just a tiny bit faster. So it was 61 milliseconds. So that was 100 times faster. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about a speed up using C++ AMP. In fact, the cartoonizing process becomes so much faster that we're able to say, well, I tell you what, let's try just making it way more cartoony and do a much harder job. So if I bring the original picture back and cartoonize it again, yeah, okay, so it took 200 milliseconds. No big deal. Apparently time is cheap now. And this is one of the important things that happens when you get this kind of a speed up in your application, that it can turn from getting the same answer a lot quicker into getting a much better answer. And it's up to you to decide which of the two kind of parts of the benefit you want to get in your particular application. But these kinds of speed ups, 50 times, is a reasonable thing to be looking for. Now, you do have to be fair. This numbers up here are breaking down the various different tasks involved in cartoonizing the image. And the middle cartoonizing bit got a lot faster. The other parts, reading the file off the hard drive, putting the pixels somewhere for you to see, handling my clicking on the buttons, they didn't get faster. So if you can imagine a job that's got 5 or 10 seconds of speed up and then 6 weeks of calculating, and then 5 or 10 seconds of the opposite of setup, then if we can shrink out that 6 weeks by a factor of 100, we're really happy. But if you have 10 minutes of setup, 30 seconds of calculating, and 10 minutes of dealing with the results of the calculating, then you're not so happy, right? So you have to be aware of the parts of your application that would always be sequential, like reading a file off the hard drive, and the parts that have the chance to be massively parallelized. So I wanted to start with the benefit for you before I got into the how to do it, because it's pretty simple, but it's not drag and drop simple. And I want you to be motivated to know why you would want to learn a new set of libraries in order to get this speed up in your code. So accelerated massive parallelism. Massive because instead of just running your code on a couple of cores or 4 cores or 8 cores, it runs your code on an accelerator. Now, today's accelerators are essentially GPUs. But there have been sessions in which there have been hints and suggestions that there will be other kinds of accelerators available to you someday in the future. For now, I'm going to kind of use the word accelerator and GPU interchangeably, but it's important to know that C++ AMP targets an accelerator, and it has that future-proofness available to it. Your application is written in C++. There isn't some separate component in some other language that you have to link in. It's all together in Visual Studio, a file of C++. It's mostly, basically, essentially a library. And not just any library, but a library that's included in VC Redist. So your deployment hassles, we're talking about portability. Really, you don't have deployment hassles. You've got to get Redist onto the machine anyway, so that's your only issue. There is a tiny, two tiny keywords, and I'll point one of them out as we go, and the other is a little bit out of scope, but they don't have a big impact in terms of, oh, what if I broke my other code? You need to mostly think about it as being a library. The other way that this is portable is that the spec, the big long document, which I've read more than once, describing how this all works, what the types are, what they do, what the behavior is when you call this function or set that property, is open and has been open from the day that AMP was first demoed. So it's possible, in fact, it's happening for other vendors of entirely different compilers who have nothing to do with Microsoft to put that same basically API interface, and you can take your code and march it over to a different compiler, possibly on a different platform, and still be using C++ AMP. So you're not necessarily locked into Visual Studio if you want to use it. How many different vendors are going to pick it up and how quickly? We can all watch that together, but it has been released as a completely open spec. Now, the number one question people ask when we finally stop for questions is, what kind of hardware do you need to run it on? You need a video card that does DirectX 11. Microsoft's implementation is built on DirectX 11. So what's going on with my laptop here? There's not a lot of laptops with that kind of video card on board. So I have a docking station, and it's not even that great. I'm not a gamer, but it's a Radeon 6650. Does that ring a bell with anybody? So it's not like, oh my gosh, you won't believe the video card she has. It's just a video card, right? But it's maybe not what you would normally get in a laptop. And it got that kind of a speed up for that kind of a workload. So here's how we're going to spend our time together before you can go and eat dinner or whatever else you have in mind for your evening. We'll talk a little bit about hardware, because in order to understand some of the concepts involved in C++ AMP, you need to kind of know the difference between a CPU and a GPU. Then I'll show you the fundamentals and a demo with code, much simpler code than the cartoonizer code, which I'm not going to show you. We will talk briefly about tiling, but there usually isn't time for a tiling demo. And then I want to show you some of the tool capabilities that are in Visual Studio 2012 to support being a C++ AMP developer. And finally, I'm going to tell you what I want you to do next. So CPUs and GPUs are really different. And this was one of the harder things for me to deal with when I got excited about this technology, because I was really a sort of a poster child for the mainstream C++ developer who has not been doing anything in this space and doesn't really know how any of this stuff behaves. GPUs are kind of small and stupid, and I don't want to be mean about it. What they like to do is to do one thing, the same operation, to a very large quantity of data. So if you think about rendering images on your screen, if you're playing Halo or something, or World of Warcraft, or whatever, Minecraft now, everybody plays Minecraft, right? Whatever you're playing, there's an awful lot of pixels that need to be rendered, and the operations involved in rendering them are pretty simple. They're like adding two numbers, that kind of thing. And GPUs love to do that. That's their wheelhouse. So if you say, I have something with a million numbers in it, something else with a million numbers in it, and I need you to subtract the corresponding elements, a GPU is all over that. It loves doing that. It thinks that's great. CPUs have an entirely different life. They'll do anything you want, and they're not really set up to take advantage of you asking for the same thing over and over and over again. They kind of want to multiply this two things and then add those two things and then compare these other two things and leap around. And to that extent, they've got all kinds of like pipelining and predictioning and brilliantly managed caches. And that's wonderful if you want to write something that does different things all the time. But I think the most important difference between CPUs and GPUs now and it's not going to be the case going forward, but for now, is that almost everybody can program for a CPU, and until C++ AMP gets widely accepted, not almost everybody can program for a GPU. You had to learn quite a bit about how they worked. You had to learn possibly another language to talk to them in. It was something that you did if you really had to. So if you were doing some sort of financial calculations and it was really important to get that computing power on your side, then you went off and learned how to do it. What I'd like to see people doing is taking advantage of this power in the sort of one level down things that could do with being sped up 50 or 100 times and see that get spread out into a much, much wider range of applications. Now, as I mentioned, C++ AMP is fundamentally a library. And that library comes with Visual C++ 2012, the version that has been in various levels of previewing for quite a long time. I am doing everything with you today using the stuff I downloaded on May 31st. And there have been some tweaks and changes as we've gone through the review process. So if you want to get a hold of this code and try it out yourself, then you're going to want to be using that version. But there's no separate download. You don't have to go get the AMP library from somewhere or configure your Visual Studio to use it or turn on a special compiler switch. It just comes with. And just as when you're using the Parallel Patterns library and you say include ppl.h, when you want to use AMP, you say include amp.h. The classes I'm going to tell you about are all in a namespace called concurrency. The PPL stuff in Visual Studio 2010 was in the namespace capital C concurrency. PPL is now in lowercase c concurrency, and AMP is in lowercase c concurrency. And I think there's an alias to keep you happy, but since you're going to have to get 2012 anyway, make the habit of being a lowercase c concurrency and go forward from that. So what's in the library? There are a bunch of types, some classes. There's array and array view. They represent data that's on an accelerator that you're going to do some work with or put answers into. Extent and index, and I'll drill into these as we go forward, that are how you describe the shape of that data or your position inside that data. And then there's an accelerator and an accelerator view. And the accelerator represents a particular, let's say, video card that you're going to run your calculations on. And there's a function with several overloads called parallel for each. Now, we've talked a little bit about C++ renaissance over the last year or so. I'll tell you what I've seen a real renaissance in within C++ developers, and that's using the standard library. How many of you, just in the last year, have actually used some algorithmic function from the standard library like for each? And keep your hand up if you did it 5 years ago. Pretty much all the hands went back down. Maybe half the hands went back down. So I found that for each as a standard library function is getting a lot more traction because we can use lambdas as what we pass into that for each. And that same ability gets leveraged when we want to do C++ AMP. We call a parallel for each, and the what we want to do on each one of those threads is going to be a lambda. Now, I mentioned we had a new keyword. Here's one of them. Restrict. Restrict was technically a C keyword. Anyone ever use it? Like in the history of time? I'm getting no hands no matter how. Do you have a friend, neighbor, cousin who used it? You heard about this guy once? No. So it was a fairly safe keyword to pick up and use. And you put it on a lambda, or if you're masochistic and you're writing some sort of function object solution, then you can put it there, to say, I swear that this code is okay to run on the accelerator. And I'll tell you what you have to do to be okay to run on the accelerator in a moment. And then the compiler checks that you're telling the truth. The same way if you mark something const, the compiler makes sure you don't try to change its value, right? And the work that you hand in to a parallel for each and ask to be run on the accelerator has to be marked with this restrict keyword that says, I'm okay to be run on a C++ AMP accelerator. You can also use restrict to say, I'm okay to be run on the CPU, and I'm okay to be run on both a C++ AMP accelerator or the CPU as you like, so that you could actually write code that you could share between those two places and run the exact same lambda on the CPU or on an accelerator, which is pretty cool if you compare that to the other ways you can accelerate your code today. So what does Parallel for Each do? This is really how it all starts. When you say, I want to write C++ AMP code, I want my code to be faster, you find some place in your life where you probably have an ordinary for, or maybe it's an ordinary for each. You're dealing with a large quantity of data. You have your million things, and you need to figure out who's biggest, or add them all up, or go through and add one to them, or whatever it is that you need to do all your data. And you say, you know what? I'm going to make that a parallel for each. And that parallel for each needs to know, well, how many threads do you want? And the way that we represent how many threads you want is with this type that I'll show you shortly called an extent. And what do you want to do on each thread? Here's a lambda. So then these walls could be a little thicker, couldn't they? So you've got your parallel for each. Here's the number of threads I want you to do it over, and here's what I want you to do. All that work basically gets shipped off to the accelerator. You can forget about it. Your parallel for each actually immediately returns. It does not block or wait. Now, in most of my demos, I immediately block or wait because I want the answer back from the accelerator. But in your application, you could actually go on to doing other things on your main thread. So if you think about the cartoonizer, while it was off, you know, for that 60 milliseconds, dealing with the picture, you could be updating the state of buttons or doing some other operation that had nothing to do with calculating the pixel colors of your cartoonized image. So here's a really simple piece of code that I hope we can all read. It adds two arrays. Now, I wouldn't call this a wildly important, you know, financial calculation, but it's readable, and you can see what happens, so how we would make this C++ AMP related. So this is a function that takes a number of ordinary C-style pointers to, you know, square bracket arrays, which I know there's plenty of code like this out in the wild. And because those arrays don't know how long they are, we also have this integer n. And of course, PA, PB, and PSUM all need to point to C-style arrays that are all exactly n long. And we're just going to omit all that error checking and asserting and whatnot so that we can focus on the thrillingly exciting job of adding up our arrays. So we have a language for loop, goes from 0 to n, incrementing I. P sum at I is equal to PA at I plus PB at I. That will add up our vectors. So right now, the both halves of the screen are the same. Now I'm going to amplify. See how easy it is? Don't you all want to do that? Yeah. It's maybe a little harder. You don't just push the button on the clicker, but it's not a lot harder. So we're going to use amp.h, include it, and use namespace concurrency. Function takes the same things. We've declared three data types. I'll go through them in a minute. Change the for to a parallel for each. And then what I really think is important here is how that middle line of the for loop is pretty much identical. Right? I changed the names of the data structures, so there's sum A and B instead of P sum PA and PB. But everything else, even including square brackets, exactly the same. So it's familiar, it's comfortable, you can read it. Now let's back up and see what I did. I declared three instances of this array view. And an array view is a wrapper for CPU-located data so that CPU-located data can be easily and automatically copied to an accelerator, and if it's changed on the accelerator, it can be copied back to the CPU. So you see there's no code here that says, now please send all my data to the GPU. And there's no code here that says, could you please go and get me my data from the GPU. And that's not because it's on a PowerPoint and I didn't feel like including it. It's because ArrayView takes care of that for you. So the ArrayView called A, these are templated classes, and we'll do this, but you can probably guess just by looking. The first parameter is, what is this container contain, ints. The second one, what's its rank? It's one-dimensional. Okay. A is n long, and it's wrapped around PA, the C style. Forgive me for having all these array classes. Wait till you try to do this in Metro, as I've also done, and you get to mix platform array into the whole mix as well. So the concurrency :: array view is wrapped around the C-style square bracket array called PA. And the concurrency array view called B is wrapped around the C style square bracket array PB, and sum is wrapped around P sum. Now, my parallel for each works on the accelerator with those array views. So the first parameter to parallel for each is an extent. How many threads do you want? In this particular case, it doesn't matter how you say this. You could say, I want n threads. You could say, I want however many threads there are in A, however many threads there are in B, or however many threads there are in sum. Because for this particular problem, they're all the same. The common thing that I see over and over again is that I want as many threads as there are in the answer. So if I'm doing like a matrix multiply, I want as many threads as there are in the answer rather than in the two things that I'm multiplying. So here, we're saying sum.extent, even though we could have said n or a.extent or b.extent because they're all the same value, because we're kind of keeping that paradigm going, that comfort level going. So I want as many threads as there are elements in sum. And what will each element do, each thread do? Well, that's what the rest of the function call is. If you haven't seen lambdas being passed to function calls, you'll notice that where the language for ended with a brace, we're ending with a brace to end the lambda, round bracket semicolon to end our function call. And the lambda captures things by value, although it actually doesn't need any of them at all and could get away without capturing anything. And the parameter that's handed to each lambda as it runs is an index showing where you are in the work you're doing. So we're working our way through sum's extent and we're given an index. And then finally we have that restrict at amp to say this has to run on the accelerator. So there's some ceremony. The good news is it's kind of the same ceremony every time. I'm going to show you a more complicated example in a little while in a demo after we've gone through these types. But you'll get to recognize this. So we've declared some types, array views to wrap our CPU located data so it's happy on the accelerator. We made ourselves a parallel for each with a particular extent, and a lambda that takes an index, and then each thread when it runs will use the index to figure out kind of where it is and do the appropriate calculation. So here's an annotated picture to work you through all that again. The array view to wrap that data and give you something that can be on the accelerator. The parallel for each that will actually run that lambda on the accelerator. Each thread will run the lambda exactly once on the accelerator. The restricted amp has to be there. It says that this lambda is happy running on an amp accelerator, which will be a GPU today. How many threads to run and the shape, right? So a 100 element one-dimensional array is not the same as a 10 by 10 two-dimensional array. So an extent is more than just a number, but every one of these amp types has one. So we're just asking sum, tell me your extent. The index, which is different for each thread that runs the lambda, and working with those array view variables on the accelerator, putting the answers back in. And what you don't see is any code to do the copying, because that's done on demand. That is, when the first thread says, hey, I need the value of A, code you didn't write says, oh, cool, A is wrapped around this pointer here, we'll just copy this data up now. I need B, sure, we'll copy this data up now. And then after this loop, the first time you talk to something that's accessed through PSUM, the data will get copied back from the accelerator from sum back down into PSUM. You don't have to write that code. An extent, as I mentioned, represents a size. One-dimensional extents are really easy to understand. So E here, the top one, is a one-dimensional extent, that's the template parameter, 5 long. The minute we get into more than one dimension, I'm writing the book, I wrote these diagrams for the book, and I look at these diagrams pretty much every time I write any code at all. Because look at the two-dimensional extent, F. It's how many rows, and then how many columns. Our data is row major in a C++ AMP data structure. So we have 2 rows and 4 columns in F. And for G, our three-dimensional guy, He has two, if you will, sheets, okay, and then four rows, and then three columns. The reason for this has to do with the exact same rules for index. And in an index, we say that two positions within a data structure that differ only in their least significant dimension are next to each other in memory. Okay, that's in the spec, that's the rules. So that's why the indices come out in this order. So in our one-dimensional extent that we had before, the position that's bright red on the screen, I, is at position 0, 1, 2, 3. The position J is in row 0, 1, and then coming over, it's in column 0, 1, 2. And finally, in our three-dimensional one, K, he's in the top sheet, 0. Row-wise, you come down 0, 1, and then column-wise, you come over 0, 1, 2. The slides should be on the portal, and it's a good idea to have them handy. That's what the second bullet on this slide means when it says dense in least significant dimension. Things that differ only in their least significant dimension are next to each other in memory. You actually have to care a little bit because GPUs are super happy if they get to work on consecutive memory locations. So a CPU doesn't really care very much where stuff is, but if you say to a GPU, here's a bank of 32 pieces of memory in a row that I want you to do the exact same thing to, it just rubs its hands together in glee. And if you ask it to do something to this, and then something to this, which is 100 over, and this, which is 50 back the other direction, it's much less happy, which means much less fast. I don't actually care about the emotional state of a GPU, but I do like my code to run fast. So the thing about an array view is that it wraps up some data that you already have, and it manages the copying and the synchronization of that data back and forth for you. And in many cases, that's going to be your kind of entry point in terms of how you're going to get your data there and how you're going to bring your data back again. It's a rectangle. Its shape is described by an extent. And when you declare it, you say, I am an array view of, let's say, integers, and I'm one-dimensional or two-dimensional or whatever. You got up to 128, by the way. I don't think anybody's ever going to complain that you don't get enough dimensions. I just don't draw you pictures of more than three. So when you declare a C-style array with, let's say, 10 elements in it, and you fill it up with numbers, but in your heart, you know, it's really a rectangular array of two rows of five columns each. This is what is happening in this code. I have a vector of integers called V with 10 elements in it. I have a concurrency extent that is a two-dimensional extent called E, 2 comma 5, so two rows of five columns. And when I wrap my array view A, which is of integers and it's two-dimensional, and I pass into the constructor my extent E and my vector V, the representation of A looks like those blue and gray lines. So the first five elements get to be the first row, and the last five elements get to be the second row. If you get this wrong, strange things will happen. Because if you get it wrong in both the way in and the way out, you may think that your code is working. Depending on what your code does, it may work. But the cartoonizer, for example, each element needs to look at its neighbors above and next to and so on. And so that if instead of being mapped out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, it was mapped out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, obviously it would have a very different opinion of its neighbors. And you get really screwy results. So it does matter. It doesn't always matter on day one. But if I'm going to show you it, I'm going to show you it right. And as I said before, that implicit synchronization is super important for array views. When you have a line of code that tries to talk to some element and you're inside a parallel for each, you're on the GPU. If the data hasn't already been copied to the accelerator, it's copied to the accelerator so it can be worked to. After the parallel for each, when you try to talk to some element of the array view or of the data that it wraps, well, we need to synchronize back. Okay, fine, and we'll synchronize back. So let's do some code. A lot simpler. A lot simpler than Cartoonizer. Sorry. This is going to be matrix multiplication. So more complicated than matrix addition, but less complicated than the cartoonizer. So we'll have a quick review. We're going to make vector A here is going to be m by w, v is going to be w by n, and c is going to be m by n. This initialize array just makes random numbers and stuffs them in. Okay? And I have a for loop, a language for, that's going to go through all of the rows of the answer C. And in each row, it's going to go through each column of the answer C. And then, if you remember how to multiply matrices, if I want to do the 0, 0 element of C, I take the whole top row of A, the whole first column, 0th column of B, and I pair them up, right? Multiply A0 times B0 plus A1 times B1, and I work my way. And that's exactly what this code is doing. So here, we're taking the appropriate row and column and keeping this partial sum going, and when we're done, we put the sum of all those additions, there'll be W of those, and we put that into the answer. And then we move on to the next column of the answer, and so on, march our way through. So I'm putting this into VREF, and that's going to be a reference answer. This code, in addition to comparing the speed, will also compare that the answer is actually correct, because correctness is a feature. And you never want to give up correctness in order to get speed, or at least not deliberately, or unknowingly, let's say. Now, there is a lambda hiding in here. People don't usually notice it till I point it out, so I'm going to point it out. It runs from here to here. And there's a little timer function called timefunc that times how long something took. Now, I'm going to find a way to get this code to you, and you'll be able to take a look through timefunc. And it does some clever things like making sure that the accelerator is warmed up and that some of the initialization code that needs to happen has happened, because it's an unusual application that just multiplies two matrices and then goes home, right? Usually, you're doing a variety of things over and over again. You're doing yesterday's data, the day before's data, however many times you're iterating. And so this kind of warm-up, cool-down stuff is not a good idea to include in your timing. So timefunc runs things twice and times the second one and that kind of thing. I'm not going to show you the gory details. But timefunc takes a lambda, which is this entire CPU-based calculation, and then writes out how long that took. Then we have almost identical code for the matrix multiply. We have array views wrapping each of our same exact three guys that we declared here, VA, VB, VC. They're wrapped up in array views. And we have a parallel for each. So here's our time funk again, wrapping all of that. And here's parallel for each. So I'm saying I have a two-dimensional extent that I want you to generate threads for, and the extent I want you to use is EC, which happens to be the extent that I used for declaring C. And as I just mentioned a little while ago, when you're multiplying matrices, each of the three guys, A, B, and C, they're all a different size. And it would really be kind of awkward to structure your algorithm as what do we do for each element of A, or what do we do for each element of B, because there's typically a different number of each of those. But we can structure it pretty well for what do we do for each element of the answer, because that's exactly what was going on in our other loop. So what we're going to do is we're going to march across the width of A, working out our place in the column as we did before, and then building up these partial sums, and then putting the answer in here. Now, I want to show you two things that are a little bit of a trick. The first one is an optimization trick. I don't care what happens to be in C when we get started. It might be all zeros. If I'm using standard library vectors, they initialize their contents to zero. That's nice. If I'm using like a C-style array that I newed up, it's whatever random junk is in there. But I don't care about those numbers at all. I'm not taking what's in C and adjusting it. I'm putting brand new values into C. So here I'm telling the scheduler, when it ships all my work up to the accelerator, don't bother copying what's in C. Don't care. And that will make my application run just a teensy bit faster. The second thing is the opposite of a cheat or an optimization. This is being honest. I mentioned that the bringing your data back from the accelerator happens when you need it. Well, we don't need anything in C until we get down here to this code that goes through and compares VC to VREF element by element and make sure they're the same. I'm timing this, right? If I just did the calculation and then said, great, how long did that take? After I start checking to see if they're the same or not, that's when the data, the answer would copy back down. And that's not fair to timing. I'm not giving it an honest shake. So even though I don't need to synchronize back from the accelerator to the CPU, I can if I want, and I want. So this line of code says, please bring the data back from the accelerator down to the CPU now. And it does that before the timer finishes so that that copy to out time is included as well as the copy in time. You know, if it takes you 100 milliseconds to copy the data to the accelerator and 100 milliseconds to copy the data from the accelerator, that's a total of 200 milliseconds. And meanwhile, by using C++ AMP, you've taken your calculation from 100 milliseconds down to 1. You didn't get faster, right? You're taking 201 milliseconds now instead of 100. You didn't gain anything. So whenever you're doing these timings, you've got to include your copy time. Now, when I show you samples, they're often a little artificial. It's quite common to ship some data up there and multiply these things, figure out who the biggest is, subtract off this other thing, and do actually a bunch of different manipulations at once. So you could kind of amortize the copy over more calculations. So you don't always see a benefit with every particular sample because they're so single-purposed. But in your real life, you absolutely have to measure and you have to include the copy time in both directions in your measuring. So that's what that line of honesty is. So then we go through and we make sure that it's the correct answer and we print out whether it passed or failed. Now, this sample also goes on to do a slightly more complicated variation, which is called tiling, which is not for demo one. So let's just run this without debugging. And look at these numbers. This is maybe not quite as dramatic as the cartoonizer because it's the whole process, including the copy time and not just the cartoonizing. But on the CPU, it took 48 milliseconds to multiply these things together. And on the GPU, it took 8. That's like a 6x speed up. And I haven't written any wildly sophisticated code. I took the CPU 4 that was going through the rows and the columns and turned it into a parallel for each that goes through a rectangular extent. And the inside's pretty much exactly the same as the other guy. Except instead of row and call, I'm using these elements 1 and 0 of the index. That's all. And now, bam, the overall time, counting the copy, I'm 6x the speed. So that seems like it's something that would be worth learning more about, I hope. And it really can be that simple. So your lambda is labeled restricted AMP. What does that mean you can and can't do? Well, GPUs are very impartial. They don't care for pointer arithmetic, recursion, function pointers, the kind of stuff we're happy to do on the CPU. So we have a series of rules. First of all, if your lambda or function is labeled restricted AMP, it can only call other lambdas or functions that are restricted AMP or restricted AMP and CPU. And in order to establish this, the compiler has to be able to see all those other functions while it's compiling this one, which for all intents and purposes basically means it needs to be inlineable. Okay, if it's in some other, you know, library that you're going to link to, it can't go looking in there to see if it's restrict AMP or not, so you're not going to be happy. You can't use arbitrary data types. You can't have car, for example. You can have int, unsigned int, float double, and sort of bool. There's like a little asterisk after bool that I don't feel like explaining today. And you can make structs of these things and arrays of these things. And arrays of structs and structs of arrays and, you know, whatever works for you to make your calculations run smoothly. You capture by value. You capture actual values, not pointers, and there is only single pointers allowed to be used inside your restricted AMP function. You can't have a pointer to a pointer. Okay? But you can't capture a pointer in the first place, but you could make one and use it inside your lambda, but not any double indirection. You can't have any recursion. You can't use the word volatile. You can't have virtual functions, pointers to member functions. You're not allowed to put pointers in structs and so forth. You can't use goto. Exceptions are completely off the table. Throw, try, catch, not happening. You can't access globals or statics or anything that you didn't capture in the lambda because we're not in the same memory space. We're here on the GPU, right? We're nowhere near where you think your globals and statics are. You can't do any runtime type identification, dynamic casts and whatnot. And var args and just there's things that are not going to be acceptable on the GPU. Now, the good news is that the compiler tests this stuff for you. So you write your lambda, you make it restricted AMP, you accidentally have a short in it or a car or something, and it'll say you can't use that type. And then you'll probably shrug and say, okay, fine, I'll use an int, right? But those are the rules today, and it's possible that they'll change in a future version, and then we'll have a versioning story already settled in the spec. Those are today's rules. Now, if ArrayView doesn't work for you, there's another type called Array. And ArrayView wrapped an existing data structure, a C-style array with square brackets, or a vector from the standard library, or pretty much any collection that's got like a begin and an end and a way to iterate through it. But an array just represents a container of data. So you might be putting data into that array one element at a time, rather than wrapping up some other data structure that you already had kicking around. And it's bound to a particular accelerator. So you create an array associated with this accelerator, you put data into it or you take data out of it, and that's the accelerator that your parallel for each will run on. It's the only exception to the capture by value rule for lambdas. Your lambdas must capture absolutely everything by value except arrays. Only arrays can be captured by reference, and they must always be only captured by reference. It's just the rule. If you want to copy data into an array from some other thing you have kicking around, you need to do that explicitly. There's a copy function. There's also a copy async function. And on this slide, I'm showing you a copy async function to get data into the array. Now, just as we had to take a minute and talk about which was X and which was Y and which was height and width and up and down when we're doing extent and index, in C, when you copy, the two things mean one order. And in C++, mostly in the standard library functions, when you copy, we're the other way around. C++ AMP is C++, right? Not C. So when you copy, we are copying from the range represented by v.begin and v.end into A, the array we just made. Down at the bottom of this code block, there's another copy. We're copying from A to the starting point represented by v.begin. You might not need everything that was in the array. You might not need to copy data into it to start, or you might not need the data back from it when you're done. And for that reason, sometimes an array is the right choice to use. You use it very much like an array view. They have indexes, they have extents, it's all good. When I first started learning how to do this stuff, I was reading the spec, I was reading code, everything was great till we got to tiling. If you start trying this yourself and you kind of hit a bit of a wall when you first hit tiling, don't take it personally. Tiling is a little bit hard. But tiling is where the biggest benefit lies. Let's do a show of hands things. How many people have been programming, I don't care the language, don't care the platform, for more than 20 years? So some of you remember about how long it takes to get stuff from memory into like a register to work with it. CPUs these days have great big caches and they manage all of it for us, and we often don't need to think about that. But getting data from actual, like, RAM is super slow from the point of view of your processor. It's an incredibly slow thing to do. And there's usually caches that are physically and as well as emotionally closer to the CPU that you can get the data from more quickly. There's a cache on the GPU too, and it's pretty good. You can get data out of there 100 times the speed of getting it out of the global memory on the GPU. So, well, that's a big difference. But the GPU will not manage that cache for you. You need to manage that cache for you. And in order to manage that cache, it's really small. So I'm multiplying out these arrays in the demo I just showed you that went from 48 milliseconds down to 8 milliseconds. There happen to be 32,768 elements in the answer. Just a random number that I happen to choose. And I don't have room in that programmable cache to necessarily cache all of my data. I can only cache like a little viewport of the data at a time. So it's super fast, but it's kind of small. So if I have something like matrix multiplication, think about calculating the top row of C. First, I use the whole top row of A and the whole first column of B, and I put an answer there. And I move over one in C, and I use the whole top row of A and the second column of B. And I move over one, and I use the whole top row of A. So every guy in A is going to be used, well, as many times as there are columns in the answer. And in fact, every element in B is also going to be used as many times as there are rows in the answer. So if I could take these values from A and B and put them in a little local cache, I could get a perf boost. But I can't, there's not room to put all of A in the cache and all of B in the cache. And instead, what you have to do is work with a little viewport, and we call that a tile. So you have these tiles of threads, and all of these threads in the tile share their own little instantiation of this highly programmable, fast cache. And you have to rearrange your algorithm to be what we call a tiled algorithm, and it can get a little tricky. So I have some tiling code on the slides to show you. The coding of it is super easy. There's a parallel for each. It takes a tiled extent. There's a tiled index instead of an index. And you can just redo your calculation to be tiled. That doesn't get you anywhere. Where you get a benefit is when you start using the tile static memory. And in order to use the tile static memory, you have to break the problem up a little differently. Now I've lost my clicker. One of the things you have to worry about, the minute you've got sharing, of course, you have contention. So if I have, and I would never have such a small tile, but if I have four threads in a tile, and they're all sharing the cache, I can't have thread 0 and 1 write something into the cache, and then thread 3 and 4 trying to read something out of the cache, but it hasn't been written in yet, because they could go off in any order within the tile. So I actually have a construct within my tiled index representing a barrier that can wait. When you have a wait in your code, all of the threads in the tile will cross that barrier together. They won't jump ahead of each other. So a typical thing that you'll do is you'll say, okay, we have, it would never be four, but bear with me, we have four threads in this tile. I will make a cache with four or some multiple of four pieces of data in it, and each thread will do a quarter of the work, and we'll get the cache filled. As each thread finishes its share of the work, it'll wait. When all of the threads in the tile have done their share of the work, we'll move on, and then we can use the cache. Each of us might use every element of the cache, so might use each element four times. That's a big speed up, because we saved the cost of fetching that data from global memory four times. So that's a typical pattern that you'll see with a tiled algorithm. Let me just go. Down to the matrix multiply code. And show you the tiled version. Starts out exactly the same. We got the array views, and we discard the data in the array view in the answer because we don't need it copied up. Still have a parallel for each, but now instead of c.extent, we're using this function called tile that gives us back a tiled extent. And instead of working with just an index, we have a tiled index. I know it looks like the tile size is some sort of variable. It really isn't. It must be known at compile time. So it's a static const. That's okay. It's basically just a word for a number that the compiler knows. But you can see that our code is about twice as long now. And it's twice as long for two reasons. And if I give you all the details, I won't have time to show you the tool support. But first of all, we're breaking the algorithm up into squares. And secondly, we have these weight barriers to make sure that nobody moves on until the cache has been completely populated, and that we don't go, because we have an outer loop, that we don't go around again in the outer loop before the cache has been fully used. So the code ends up taking about twice as long, and we do get a speed up. This particular run went from 8.6 to 7.2. So, I mean, you wouldn't, before you came in and saw me speed things up by 50%, if I said I could get stuff down by 12%, you'd be like, "Woo, that's great, show me how." So it is an improvement. And I have some other algorithms that we've put tiling on where it's many, many times improvement by putting tiling on, especially when you have something that takes more than 50 milliseconds. So we chose a fairly small set of arrays in order to have the demos run quickly in front of you. We go into this in a ton more detail in the book, but some of the absolutely most astronomical speed-ups come to you from putting in the difficulty of tiling. What I really want you to see is that it is more difficult. It is about twice the length, and you have to really draw pictures and understand it. You can't just randomly say, "Ooh, I think I'll use a tiled calculation now." Yes, the question was, does the cache size vary depending on your hardware? And the answer is yes. You can't exactly be sure exactly how much cache you have. As time goes by, they will only, I presume, get bigger. But today, you sort of have to hope that there's a bare minimum that you can count on. When you go to figure out your tile size, that's when you discover when you have to test on different hardware to be confident. Now, Visual Studio has fantastic support for C++ AMP. And I've been watching that support refine as we've gone through the different releases, especially around debugging. You're writing C++, and you're debugging C++. You know, so you know how to debug. You know how to set a breakpoint, a trace point, a conditional breakpoint, hover over something for a data tip. That's all there. And in addition, there's some way cool windows that give you even more insight into what's going on, because debugging concurrent code is different from debugging sequential code. There's also some lovely tools around visualizing what's going on inside your application. Now, I would love to do a debugging demo, but today, and that's like June, what are we, 12th, 13th? Today, you can only debug on Windows 8. I am not a Microsoft employee. I have no way of telling you anything about how long that state will be the case for. That is the case today. And I didn't feel like booting my machine to Windows 8 in the middle of the presentation, so I'm going to show you screenshots of debugging. Okay? You can write your code and run your code on Windows 7. Not a problem. But if you want to debug it, you're going to do it on Windows 8. The other constraint, and it's a pretty big one today, is that you can either hit a breakpoint inside your parallel for each, a GPU breakpoint, or a breakpoint outside your parallel for each, a CPU breakpoint. And for a given run, you're going to hit either GPU or CPU breakpoints. Okay? So the way that you control this, if you're on C++ settings, how many of you are on C++ settings? Like a third. So the rest of you do some C++ and some something else. Well, if you're not on C++ settings, you won't have this drop-down next to the debug arrow. This drop-down is a great way to choose that I want to hit GPU breakpoints. If you don't have that, you can bring up the project properties and change it in here. Now, if you don't want to hit GPU breakpoints, I should be fair, you can hit your CPU breakpoints in Windows 7. Okay? But when you go to run them on Windows 8 and you want it on Windows 7 and you try to hit a GPU breakpoint, you can't hit it. So this is just a regular living your life debugging stuff, right? I've got some autos down at the bottom, I and IDX and IDXA. I got a call stack. I can see where the current line of execution is, and I've paused over result, and I can see its numerical value. But all of that code is actually running on the video card, not on the CPU. So we feel exactly like the debugging we know how to do. We're not hardware debugging against this video card. It's running on an accelerator, and that accelerator happens to be a software emulator. If you have the right driver, you can debug on your real video card, but if your vendor doesn't happen to have that driver available, and there's a very small group of vendors and cards for which it is, then you're actually on a reference emulator, which is slow, but a perfectly good emulator. So some new windows that have been added. This is the GPU threads window down on the bottom of the screen. You can see it says 252 threads are at line 130, and 4 threads are at line 131. So we have a tile of 256 threads, I guess. And there's some stuff going on in the margins. The red dot is a breakpoint. The little wiggles is a thread marker showing that some threads are there. And then there's another little wiggles with a yellow arrow on top of them so you can't really see it, indicating that some threads are there. The reason so many threads are at line 130 is they're waiting at the tile barrier. It's a parallel watch window. I dragged it up next to the code. I mean, you can switch from thread to thread using the GPU threads window and see what the value is by hovering over a result every time. But here, I've put a parallel watch on the sum, and I can see what the sum is across all those different threads at once. And just as you expect in your watch and locals windows, if something's changed recently, it goes red. So when you're running in the emulator, 4 threads at a time go forward, and so 4 values are bright red because they're the ones that just changed on the most recent execution step. If you forget your weight, your tile barrier weight, after or before working with the cache, it can actually find that for you. You have to turn on an option, but it's not very hard. And then it'll say, hey, you're reading and writing in the wrong order. You may have a race condition here. You may have a missing weight. There's a parallel stacks window, which is very helpful if you have code that calls code that calls code, and you want to figure out who's where. And you can filter in one of those windows, let's say in the GPU threads window, you can say, I only want to see these threads here that are past the barrier. I only want to see these other threads that have a positive value for sum. So you can group and filter according to a wide variety of different conditions. And you can even take over from the scheduler and schedule the threads yourself in a different way than it would have in order to see what would happen if things were being done differently. It's a very powerful set of GPU debugging support built into Visual Studio. There's also the concurrency visualizer. Now, some of you indicated you're familiar with PPL, and some of you may also know TPL for managed code. So who's used the concurrency visualizer before? Anybody? Wow, it's like 2 hands out of the whole room. This is really a way to show you what is happening. And when you're doing CPU-based concurrency visualizer, it's a great way to see if you've made some expensively, accidentally sequential code. You know, is your code really using all your cores? Is this calculation really quicker when you do it in parallel than it was when you did it sequentially? And the same thing holds when you use the concurrency visualizer for your C++ AMP accelerated code. It's very good for you to be able to see this is how long this part of the calculation took, this is how long that part of the calculation took, and it also shows you the times to copy the data back and forth to and from the accelerator. So I have a screenshot here. And this is actually the same Cartoonizer demo that I opened with. You can see there's some little teeny spikes that don't last long. Width on this diagram is time going by. That's actually me interacting with the buttons of the MFC app and flipping through the different photographs. Then the first kind of blah, short, it's only one core high. The vertical axis on the big graph is CPU cores. So it's quite wide, and it's one core high. That's the single core calculation that took 6 seconds. Doesn't want to show me the mouse, and I don't. Yeah. This first guy here. Okay? Then there's some little teeny spikes, and then there's a spike that's much higher. He goes up to 4 cores. That's the PPL code that used all 4 cores on my laptop. And you can see how much narrower he is. Third, quarter, something like that. That demonstrates very clearly, if we didn't have that timing code up in the top corner, that the PPL code is way faster than the single core CPU code. But then, here's where things are really fun. And I will come down and point for these. there's these tiny little blips right here. Those are the GPU handling the same work, the exact same work. And as you can see, the CPU barely managed to get up above a single core while that was going on. It had really nothing to do. And that's a very dramatic demonstration of just how much faster this code got when we moved that workload off into the accelerator. If it didn't, if we still had stripes of green the exact same length, we wouldn't have gained anything from pulling this work into moving it onto that accelerator. And I have a close-up. The y-axis on this one, the big top y, is just number of cores. And down on the bottom is number of GPU engines, which doesn't mean much, because some of the engines are dedicated to different kinds of work. So the only thing that's really super useful on the second one, which I zoom in on here, is the width. And we went from two passes of going through to look for similar colors, and I cranked it up to like 20, so it's way more cartoony, and you barely saw any impact on the GPU. So obviously, when you write real applications, you're probably not going to use the time funk that I used in matrix multiply to print out numerically how many milliseconds it was. And you're probably not going to add controls on your MFC application that say how many milliseconds a particular process took. That's great for me to show you the code. But when you write your own apps, you still want that insight. And that's what the concurrency visualizer can bring you, where you can actually see if you have two different things that you do, this one takes longer than that one. Maybe this is the one I should think about parallelizing. You have to bring a kind of a test plan to the table when you see a thread like this, a trace like this. In order to understand it, you have to know exactly what you did. So if you're doing image manipulation, you can say, I'll do it the slowest way, then I'll do it the medium way, then I'll do it the fast way, and then you'll recognize the spots. And it's as simple even as knowing, well, yes, I clicked the load button three times in quick succession, so there's three little spikes before each of the big calculation ones. And you'll gain that familiarity with how your code runs. There are way more views in Concurrency Visualizer than I have time to show you, that you can actually drill into looking at the difference between executing on the GPU versus syncing data back and forth. You can look at the time that your CPU thread. Remember I said, when you come out of your parallel for each, he doesn't block. He carries right on with what he's doing. But if you need the answer, you may sit and block there while it copies back. And the concurrency visualizer can show you that as well. So you can get a lot of insight into what's going on inside your application using this tool. When I tell people I'm doing a talk on C++ AMP, they all say, what is that? And I say, because it's just the coolest name, I say, well, that's accelerated massive parallelism. And that's a fun answer, but it's not. They didn't really learn anything from my saying that, right? So what I want you to think of what C++ AMP is, it's a way to make your code many, many times faster, not percent, but many times faster, maybe 50 times faster, maybe 100 times faster. It's a total game changer. Imagine that you have a finance calculation that will scour the market data all over the world and spot holes, things that aren't quite right. And you've been working on this in your basement for a long time, and it's perfect. It takes 30 days to run. When it's finished, it tells you what you should have done 30 days ago, and it's always right. But of course, the moment's passed. But it's massively parallel. You're looking at a whole lot of data all at once, subtracting things, dividing by the average or something else. And so you speed it up by a factor of 100. So now instead of 30 days, it takes a third of a day, 8 hours, you know, overnight while the markets are closed. In the morning, you get up and you do what it says to do. There's your retirement taken care of. You deal with the bit where you make the perfect, you know, I'll leave that part as an exercise for you. But here's another one that's not so nice. Got a nice good password, you know? You got some funny characters in it, some capital letters, blah, blah. It's not LinkedIn. Apparently, like, half the passwords on LinkedIn were LinkedIn. And, in fact, you've run your password through something that will tell you how complicated it is, and you have reason to believe that it'll take 100 days to crack your password by brute force. And you change it every 30 days, so you feel pretty smug. until the bad guy password cracker also finds out that he can speed up his code by 100 times, and now it takes one day to crack your password by brute force. Okay, so this is a technology that's actually really a game changer. It changes the world that we live in terms of what calculations can be done and when. But for you as a C++ developer who's saying, should I be using this in my app? If I've got something that's kind of data parallel, I need to work with some big data sets, and I need to do some pretty simple things to those data sets, like multiplying matrices or adjusting pixels or looking for the difference between adjacent things. Well, then you need to know that C++ is the language you know, the language you're productive in, the tools you know how to use, the language you go to for performance. It's pretty much always just a library, really easy to deploy, so you've got great portability, and it's well supported by Visual Studio 2012. You've got a debugger, and if you have the right SKUs, and I don't know what the SKUs are yet, you'll have concurrency visualizer. You've got, you know, file open, search everywhere, code analysis, TFS support, everything that's Visual Studio. You don't have to go into another tool. And it's portable. I'm doing this demo with you on AMD cards, but the exact same executables, I go and run them on NVIDIA cards. Okay? As part of the book, I took a USB key with nothing more than the XE and the VC redist and went to all kinds of machines, including machines that didn't even have Visual Studio installed on them, and just kept running it over and over again to get numbers. It's not a problem. That's a level of portability that's very nice to achieve. And it's even possible that there may be a future portability to other compilers who pick up on that open spec. Who wants to start? Who wants to learn something? More wants to go beyond this and learn more. Yes, thank you. Lots of hands. Yay. Now, I'm not being selfish by having my URL big and the other URLs little. I'm really not. Because the URL at the bottom links to everything. Okay? In fact, I have... Let me just flip. I have the blog, that's what the big ones at the bottom of that slide are, up here, and you can see down the side, it says in large letters, start here. It's very subtle. And there are samples. The samples absolutely rock. You can see there's dozens of them, including, I absolutely adore the samples that show you how to do this from C#. Do you know how you do this from C#? You p-invoke to some C++ library that does it. That's how you do this from C#. Damn right. Okay, but you can also see links to the book and the course and all kinds of good stuff on the side. So where it says start here, that's what you want. So I have put a reasonably large size link to my book that I'm writing with aid. I do have a wonderful co-author who I'm lucky to have, to a training course. And then all those videos, articles, samples, guides, spec, and forum are all reachable from that big bottom link, blogs.msdn.com/native-concurrency. I want you, if you don't already, to go get Visual Studio 2012. Then I want you to go to that blog, hit that samples link, and get a sample and try it. Do it on Windows 8. What the heck, you're downloading the beta for Visual Studio 2012. Get Windows 8 while you're at it so that you can play with the debugger and see the things I showed you. And then try writing something of your own. Something on a command prompt, Windows app. Write a Metro-style app. I've done that, and it's very interesting and not as hard as I thought it was going to be. And really measure the performance you get so that you can see the difference right away. I have 1.5 minutes for questions, so I will take some. What's that? You want the blog URL again? There you go. And I will leave that up, and I will not put up the slide that begs you to do your evals. And instead, I will beg you to do your evals. The same thing I say every year. I love speaking at TechEd. I want to come back. I love that there are more C++ sessions than usual at TechEd. I'd like that to continue. So you have the power to tell them that you're happy that there are C++ sessions and you're happy that I gave them. If that's how you feel, do tell them. If it's not how you feel, also let me know, because I'd like to know. And I will have to do questions one-on-one because I've run out of time. So thank you all very much.